chair and sitting down.
"Thanks for getting back to me, Miss Spencer."
"Mrs.," she said, sounding very slightly amused. "Can I just ask, are you the Cormoran Strike?"
"I doubt there are many others," said Strike.
He reached for his cigarettes, then pushed them away again. He really did need to cut down.
"I see," said Claire Spencer. "Well, it was a bit of a shock to get a message from you. How do you know the Athorns?"
"Their name came up," said Strike, thinking how very inaccurate a statement that was, "in the course of a case I'm investigating."
"Was it you who went into their downstairs neighbour's shop and threatened him?"
"I didn't threaten him," said Strike, "but his attitude seemed aggressive, so I pointed out that they had friends who might take it amiss if he bullied them."
"Ha!" said Claire, sounding warmer. "He's a horror, that man. He's been trying to get them out of that flat for ages. Wants to buy the whole building. He removed a supporting wall, then tried to blame Deborah and Sowen for his ceiling sagging. He's caused them a lot of stress."
"That flat was," Strike almost said, "mucked out," but tried to find a politer way of saying it. "Thoroughly cleaned recently," he said.
"Yes. I'm not denying it was pretty messy, but we've sorted that out now. And as for saying they've caused structural damage, we got a surveyor in, who went through the whole place and agreed there's nothing wrong with it. What a chancer the man is. Anyway, you did a good thing there, warning him off. He thinks because they haven't got many close relatives, he can get away with browbeating them. So what's this case you're investigating?"
Briefly, Strike told her about Margot Bamborough, her disappearance in 1974, and the information that had led him to the Athorns' door.
"And so," he concluded, "I wanted to talk to someone who could tell me how much reliance I can put on what they've told me."
There was a brief silence.
"I see," said Claire, who sounded a little more guarded now. "Well, I'm afraid I've got a duty of confidentiality as their social worker, so could I ask you some questions?
And if you can't answer, obviously I'll accept that."
"All right," she said.
He had the impression that his actions with regard to the bullying ironmonger had put her on his side.
"They're clearly competent to live alone," said Strike.
"With support, yes," said Claire. "They've done very well, actually. They've got a strong mutual bond. It's probably kept both of them out of institutionalized care."
"And what exactly?"
Strike wondered how to word the question sensitively.
Claire came to his aid. "Fragile X syndrome," she said. "Deborah's relatively high-functioning, although she's got some social difficulties, but she can read and so forth. Sowen copes better socially, but his cognitive impairment's greater than his mother's."
"And the father, Wilhelm?"
Claire laughed. "I've only been their social worker for a couple of years. I never knew Wilhelm."
"You can't tell me how sane he was."
There was a longer pause.
"Well," she said, "I suppose it seems to be common knowledge that he was very odd. Various family members have spoken to me about him. Apparently he thought he could hex people with black magic, you know."
"Deborah told me something I found slightly concerning. It involved a doctor called Dr. Brenner, who was a partner of Dr. Bamborough's at the St. John's practice. She might have been referring to a medical examination, but—"
He thought Claire had said something.
"Sorry?"
"No, nothing. What exactly did she tell you?"
"Well," said Strike, "she mentioned having to take her pants off, and not wanting to, but she said Wilhelm told her she had to. I assumed—"
"This was a doctor?"
"Yes," said Strike.
There was another, longer pause.
"I really don't know what to tell you," said Claire finally. "It's possible that was a medical examination, but, well, a lot of men used to visit that flat."
Strike said nothing, wondering whether he was being told what he thought he was being told.
"Wilhelm had to get drink and drugs money somewhere," said Claire. "From what Deborah's disclosed to social workers over the years, we think he was, well, not to put too fine a point on it, we think he was pimping her out."
"Christ," muttered Strike in disgust.
"I know," said Claire. "From bits and pieces she's told caregivers, We think Guillaume used to take Sowen out whenever she was with a client. It is dreadful. She's so vulnerable. On balance, I can't be sorry Guillaume died young. But please, don't mention any of this to Deborah's family if you speak to them. I've no idea how much they know, and she's happy and settled these days. There's no need to upset anyone.
No, of course not, said Strike. And he remembered Sowen's words, Old Joe Brenner was a dirty old man. How reliable would you say Sowen's memory is?
Why? What's he told you?
A couple of things his Uncle Tudor said.
Well, people with Fragile X usually have quite good long-term memories, said Claire cautiously. I'd say he'd be more reliable about things his Uncle Tudor told him than on many subjects.
Apparently Uncle Tudor had a theory about what happened to Margot Bamborough. It involved some people called Nico and his boys.
Ah, said Claire. Yes. Do you know who that is?
Go on.
There was an old gangster who used to live in Clerkenwell, said Claire, called Niccolo Ricci. Sowen likes talking about Nico and his boys, like they're folk heroes or something. They talked for a couple more minutes, but Claire had nothing more of interest to tell.
Well, thanks very much for getting back to me, said Strike. Social workers work Saturdays as well as detectives, I see.
People don't stop needing help at weekends, she said dryly. Good luck. I hope you find out what happened to that poor doctor.
But he could tell by her tone, however friendly, that she thought it highly unlikely. Strike's headache had now settled into a dull throb that increased if he bent over or stood up too suddenly. He returned to his methodical arrangements for next day's departure to Cornwall, emptying his fridge of perishables, making sandwiches for the trip, listening to the news, which told him that three people had died that day as a result of the adverse weather conditions, packing his kit bag, ensuring his emails were up to date, setting up an out-of-office message redirecting potential clients to Pat, and checking the rota to make sure it had been altered to accommodate his absence. Through all these tasks, he kept an ear out for his mobile, in case a text from Robin arrived. But nothing came. Finally, at 8 o'clock, while he was finishing cooking the fry-up he felt he was owed given his hangover and how hard he'd worked all day, his mobile buzzed at last. From across the table, he saw that three long consecutive texts had arrived. Knowing that he was leaving the following morning without any clear idea of when he'd be back, Robin appeared to have begun the reconciliation process, as women were wont to do, with an essay on her various grievances. He opened the first message, magnanimously prepared to accept almost any terms for a negotiated peace, and only then realized that it was from an unknown number. I thought today was Valentine's Day, but I've just realized it's the 15th. They've got me on so many drugs in here I can hardly remember my name. I'm in a place again. This isn't my phone. There's another woman here who's allowed one, and she lent it to me. Yours is the only mobile number I know by heart. Why didn't you ever change it? Was it because of me, or is that my vanity? I'm so full of drugs I can't feel anything, but I know I love you. I wonder how much they'd have to give me before that went too. Enough to kill me, I suppose. The next message, from the same number, read, How did you spend Valentine's Day? Did you have sex? I'm here partly because I don't want sex. I can't stand him touching me, and I know he wants more kids. I'd rather die than have more. Actually, I'd rather die than most things. But you know that about me. Will I ever see you again? You could come and see me here. Today I imagined you walking in, like I did, when your leg. I imagine you telling them to let me go, because you loved me, and you'd look after me. I cried and... The third message continued. The psychiatrist was pleased to see me crying, because they like emotion. I don't know what the whole address is, but it's called Simmons House. I love you. Don't forget me, whatever happens to me. I love you. A fourth and final message read, It's Charlotte, in case that isn't obvious. Strike read the entire thread through twice. Then he closed his eyes, and like millions of his fellow humans, wondered why troubles could never come singly but in avalanches, so that you became increasingly destabilized with every blow that hit you. Chapter 43. And you, fair Lady Night, my dearest dame, relent the rigour of your wrathful will, whose fire were better turned to other flame, and wiping out remembrance of all ill, grant him your grace. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. To Robin's relief, her three guests got up early the next morning because they wanted to spend a full day in London. All were subdued after what Robin thought of as the nightmare dinner. She dreaded a tearful plea for forgiveness from Courtney, who seemed especially low, so Robin faked a cheery briskness she certainly didn't feel, making recommendations for cheap places to eat and good things to see before waving the students off. As Robin was due to run surveillance on Eleanor Dean overnight, she'd given Jonathan a spare key and wasn't sorry that she'd probably still be in Stoke Newington when the students returned to Manchester, because they intended to catch a mid-morning Sunday train. Not wanting to be alone with Max, in case he wanted a post-mortem on the previous evening, Robin made herself a voluntary prisoner in her own bedroom all day, where she continued to work on her laptop, attempting to block out waves of anger towards Strike, and a tearfulness that kept threatening to overcome her. Hard as she tried to concentrate on finding out who'd been living in Jerusalem Passage when Margot disappeared, however, her thoughts kept returning to her partner. Robin wasn't in the least surprised not to have heard from him, but was damned if she'd initiate contact. She couldn't, in good conscience, retract a word of what she said after watching him vomit in the gutter, because she was tired of being taken for granted in ways Strike didn't recognize. But as the afternoon wore on, and the rain continued to fall outside her window, and while she hadn't been nearly as drunk as Strike, she developed a dull headache. Equal parts of misery and rage dragged at her every time she remembered last night's dinner, and all the things she'd shouted at Strike in the street. She wished she could cry, but the tightness in her chest prevented her doing so. Her anger boiled anew every time she remembered the drunk Strike attacking her guests, but then she found herself rerunning Courtney and Kyle's arguments in her head. She was sure none of the students had ever brushed up against the ugliness Robin had encountered, not merely under that dark stare in her hall of residence, but during her work with Strike. Battered women, raped girls, death. They didn't want to hear Strike stories, because it was so much more comforting to believe that language alone could remake the world. But none of that made her feel more kindly to her partner. On the contrary, she'd resented agreeing with him. He'd been looking for someone or something to attack, and it was she who'd paid the price. Robin forced herself to keep working, because work was her one constant, her salvation. By 8 in the evening, Robin was as sure as a thorough perusal of online records could make her that nobody living in Jerusalem Passage had been there for 40 years. By this time, she was so hungry that she really did need to eat something, which she feared meant facing Max and discussing Strike. Sure enough, when she reached the living area, she found Max sitting watching TV with Wolfgang on his lap. He muted the news the moment he saw her, and Robin's heart sank.
"Evening."
"Hi," said Robin. "I'm going to make myself something to eat. Do you want anything?"
"There's still a bit of casserole if you want it."
"Strike didn't finish it all, then?" She mentioned him first in the spirit of getting it over with. She could tell that Max had things to say.
"No," said Max.
He lifted the sleepy Wolfgang onto the sofa beside him, stood up, and moved to the kitchen. "I'll heat it up for you."
"There's no need, I can't—"
But Max did so. And when Robin was settled at the table with her food and drink, he sat down at the table with her with a beer. This was highly unusual, and Robin felt suddenly nervous. Was she being softened up for some kind of unwelcome announcement? Had Max decided, after all, to sell up?
"Never told you how I ended up in such a nice flat, did I?" he said.
"No,"
said Robin cautiously. I had a big payout. 5 years ago. Medical negligence.
Oh,
said Robin. There was a pause. Max smiled. People usually say shit, what went wrong? But you never probe, do you? I've noticed that. You don't ask a lot of questions.
Well, I have to do a lot of that at work, said Robin.
But that wasn't why she hadn't asked Max about his finances, and it wasn't why she didn't ask now what had gone wrong with his body or his treatment, either. Robin had too many things in her own past that she didn't want endlessly probed to want to cause other people discomfort.
I was having palpitations 7 years ago, said Max, examining the label on his beer. Arrhythmia. I got referred to a heart specialist and he operated. Opened me up and ablated my sinus node.
You probably don't know what that is, he said, glancing up at Robin, and she shook her head.
I didn't either, until they ballsed mine up. Basically, they knackered my heart's ability to beat for itself. I ended up having to be fitted with a pacemaker.
Oh, no, said Robin, a bit of beef suspended in mid-air on her fork.
And the best bit was, said Max, none of it was necessary. There wasn't anything wrong with my sinus node in the first place. Turned out I hadn't been suffering from atrial tachycardia at all. It was stage fright.
Max, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it wasn't good, said Max, taking a sip of his beer. Two unnecessary open-heart surgeries, endless complications. I lost jobs. I was unemployed for 4 years, and I'm still on antidepressants. Matthew said I had to pursue a claim against the doctors. I probably wouldn't have done if he hadn't nagged me. Lawyer's fees, ton of stress. But I won in the end, got a big payout. And he persuaded me to sink it all into a decent property. He's a barrister. He earns great money. Anyway, we bought this place. Max pushed his thick blonde hair out of his face and glanced down at Wolfgang, who trotted to the table to savour the smell of casserole once more.
A week after we moved in, he sat me down and told me he was leaving. The ink was barely dry on the mortgage. He said he'd struggled against it because he felt a loyalty to me, because of what I'd been through, but he couldn't fight his feelings any longer.
He told me, said Max with a hollow smile, he'd realized pity wasn't love. He wanted me to keep the flat, didn't want me to buy him out, as if I could have done. So he signed over his half. That was to make him feel less guilty, obviously. And off he went with Tiago. He's Brazilian, the new guy. Owns a restaurant.
That, said Robin quietly, sounds like hell.
Yeah, it was. I really need to stop looking at their bloody Instagram accounts. Max heaved a deep sigh and absent-mindedly rubbed the shirt over the scars on his chest. Obviously, I thought of just selling up. But we barely lived here together, so it's not as though it's got a ton of memories. I didn't have the energy to go through more house hunting and moving. So here I've stayed, struggling to make the mortgage every month.
Robin thought she knew why Max was telling her all this, and her hunch was confirmed when he looked directly at her and said,
Anyway, I just wanted to say, I'm sorry about what happened to you. I had no idea. Isla only told me you were held at gunpoint.
Oh, I didn't get raped then, said Robin. And to Max's evident surprise, she started to laugh.
Doubtless it was her tiredness, but it was a relief to find dark comedy in this litany of terrible things humans did to each other, though none of it was really funny at all.
His mutilated heart, the gorilla mask in her nightmares.
No, the rape happened 10 years ago. That's why I dropped out of university.
Shit, said Max.
Yeah, said Robin. And echoing Max, she said, It wasn't good.
So, when did the knife thing happen? Asked Max, eyes on Robin's forearm, and she laughed again.
Really, what else was there to do?
That was a couple of years ago.
Working for Strike?
Yes, said Robin, and she stopped laughing now.
Listen, about last night.
I enjoyed last night, said Max.
You can't be serious, said Robin.
I'm completely serious.
It was really useful for building my character. He's got some proper big man take-no-bullshit energy about him, hasn't he?
You mean he acts like a dick?
Max laughed and shrugged.
Is he very different sober?
Yes, said Robin.
Well, I don't know. Less of a dick.
And before Max could ask anything else about her partner, she said quickly,
He's right about your cooking anyway. That was fantastic. Thanks so much, I really needed that.
Having cleared up, Robin returned downstairs, where she showered before changing for the night's surveillance. With an hour to go before she needed to take over from Hutchins, she sat back down on her bed and idly typed variations on the name Paul Satchwell into Google. Paul L. Satchwell, L.P. Satchwell, Paul Leonard Satchwell, Leo Paul Satchwell. Her mobile rang. She glanced down. It was Strike. After a moment or two, she picked it up, but said nothing.
Robin?
Yes.
Are you okay to talk?
Yes, she said again, her heart beating faster than usual as she frowned up at the ceiling.
Calling to apologize.
Robin was so astonished she said nothing for several seconds. Then she cleared her throat and said,
Can you even remember what you're apologizing for?
Yeah, I think so, said Strike. I didn't mean that to get dragged up. Should have realized it wasn't a subject you'd want discussed over dinner. Didn't think.
Tears started in Robin's eyes at last.
Okay, she said, trying to sound casual.
And I'm sorry for being rude to your brother and his friends.
Thank you, said Robin.
There was a silence. The rain still fell outside. Then Strike said,
Have you heard from Isla?
No, said Robin. Have you heard from Nick?
No, said Strike.
There was another silence.
So we're okay, yeah? Said Strike.
Yes, said Robin, wondering whether it was true.
If I've taken you for granted, said Strike, I'm sorry. You're the best I've got.
Oh, for fuck's sake, Strike, said Robin,
abandoning the pretense that she wasn't crying as she snorted back tears.
What?
You're bloody infuriating.
Why?
Saying that, now.
That's not the first time I've said it.
It is, actually.
I've told other people.
Yeah, well,
said Robin, now laughing and crying simultaneously as she reached for tissues.
You see how that isn't the same thing as telling me?
Yeah, I suppose, said Strike. Now you mention it.
He was smoking at his small formica kitchen table while the eternal rain fell outside his attic window. Somehow, the text from Charlotte had made him realize he had to call Robin, had to make things right with her before he set off for Cornwall and Joan. Now the sound of her voice and her laughter acted on him as it usually did, by making everything seem fractionally less awful.
When are you leaving? Robin asked, drying her eyes.
Tomorrow at 8. Lucy's meeting me at the car hire. We've got a jeep.
Well, be careful, said Robin.
She'd heard on the news that day about the three people who died trying to travel through the wind and the floods.
Yeah, can't pretend I don't wish you were driving. Lucy's bloody terrible behind the wheel.
You can stop flattering me now. I've forgiven you.
I'm serious, said Strike,
his eyes on the relentless rain.
You and your advanced driving course, you're the only person who doesn't scare the shit out of me behind the wheel.
Do you think you'll make it?
Possibly not all the way in the jeep, but Paul was standing by to rescue us. He's got access to dinghies. We've got to do it. Joan might only have days.
Well, I'll be thinking about you, said Robin, keeping everything crossed.
Cheers, Robin. Keep in touch.
After Strike had hung up, Robin sat for a while, savouring the sudden feeling of lightness that had filled her. Then she pulled her laptop towards her, ready to shut it down before she left for her night surveillance in the Land Rover. Casually, as she might have thrown the dice one last time before turning away from the craps table, she typed Paul Satchwell Artist into Google. Artist Paul Satchwell has spent most of his career on the Greek island of...
What?
said Robin aloud, as though the laptop had spoken to her. She clicked on the result, and the website of the Leamington Spa Museum and Art Gallery filled the screen. She hadn't once seen it in all her hours of searching for Satchwell. This page had either just been created or amended. Temporary Exhibition, March the 3rd to the 7th, 2014. Local Artists. The Leamington Spa Museum and Art Gallery will be hosting a temporary exhibition of artists from the Warwickshire area, entrance free. Robin scrolled down the page past sundry artists' photos until she saw him. It was, without a doubt, the same man. His face might be leathery and cracked, his teeth might have yellowed, his thick curly hair turned whiter and thinner, but it still hung to his shoulders, while his open shirt showed thick white chest hair. Born in Leamington Spa and raised in Warwick, artist Paul Satchwell has spent most of his career on the Greek island of Kos. Working mainly in oils, Paul's Hellenic-influenced exploration of myths challenged the viewer to face primal fears and examine preconceptions through sensual use of line and colour. Chapter 44. Huge sea of sorrow and tempestuous grief, wherein my feeble bark is tossed long, far from the hoped haven of relief. Why do thy cruel billows beat so strong, and thy moist mountains each on others throng, threatening to swallow up my fearful life? Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. The storm water, rain and gales they faced were real enough, yet Strike and Luce's battle to reach St. Maur's had a strange, dreamlike quality. Both knew death lay at the end. Both were resolved that if they managed to reach Joan alive, they would stay with her until she died. Trees swayed and creaked as they sped along the motorway. They had to divert around great wide lakes where lately there had been fields, forcing them miles out of their way. Twice they were halted at roadblocks and told, by irate police, to turn back. They pressed on, at one point driving 50 miles to progress 15, listening to every weather update on the radio, and becoming progressively more certain that there would come a point where they had to abandon the jeep. Rain lashed the car, high winds lifted the windscreen wipers from the glass, and brother and sister took it in turns to drive, bound by a single objective, and temporarily freed from all other concerns. To Strike's grateful surprise, the crisis had revealed a different Lucy, just as illness had uncovered a different Joan. His sister was focused entirely on what needed to be done. Even her driving was different, without three noisy sons in the back seat, squabbling and thumping each other if the journey lasted longer than 20 minutes. He'd forgotten how efficient and practical Lucy could be, how patient, how resolute. Her calm determination only broke when they reached an impasse 30 miles from St. Maur's, where flooding and fallen trees had rendered the road impassable. While Lucy sat slumped at the steering wheel, sobbing with her face in her arms, Strike left the jeep to stand outside under a tree, where, sheltering from the perennial rain and taking the opportunity to smoke, he called Dave Polworth, who was holding himself ready to assist them.
"Yeah, we thought that's where you'd have to stop," said Polworth,
when Strike had given him their position.
"Who's we?"
"Well, I can't fucking do this alone, can I, Diddy? Should be with you in an hour. Stay in the car."
And an hour later, true to his word, Dave Polworth and 5 other men, 2 of them members of the local lifeguard, 3 old school friends of Strike's, emerged out of the gathering gloom. Dressed in waterproofs and carrying waders ready for the worst passages, the men took charge of Strike and Lucy's bags. Leaving the jeep parked up a side street, the party set off on foot. The end of Stripe's stump began to chafe long before they had walked for 2 hours solid over boggy ground and slippery tarmac. Soon, he had to abandon pride and allow 2 of his old school friends to support him on either side. Darkness fell before they reached the couple of dinghies that Polworth had arranged to carry them over flooded fields. Using oars to alternately row and punt themselves along, they navigated with the aid of torches and compasses. Polworth had called on every friend and acquaintance he knew to arrange Strike and Lucy's passage across the storm-ravaged peninsula. They covered several miles by tractor pulling a trailer, but at some passages were forced to wade through feet of icy flood water, the diminutive Lucy accepting a piggyback from the largest lifeboatman. 4 hours after they'd abandoned the jeep, they reached St. Maur's. At the gate of Ted and Joan's house, brother and sister hugged each of their escorts goodbye.
"Don't start," said Polwarth,
as the weary and sore Strike tried to put into words what he felt to be incommunicable.
"Get inside, or what the fuck was it all for?"
Ted, whom they'd updated regularly through their journey, greeted them in pyjamas at the back door, tears running down the deep folds in his craggy face.
"I never thought you'd get here," he kept saying, as he made them tea. "Never thought you'd make it."
"How is she?"
asked the shivering Lucy, as the three of them sat in the kitchen, their hands around mugs of tea, eating toast.
"She managed a bit of soup today," said Ted. She sleeps a lot. But when she's awake, she likes to talk. Oh, she'll be over the moon to have you two here."
And so began days that had the same strange outside time quality of their journey. Initially, Strike, the end of whose stump was rubbed raw after the painful exigencies of their journey, abandoned his prosthesis and navigated the small house by hopping and holding onto chair backs and walls. He read and responded to Robin's emails about the agency's work, but her news seemed to come from a place far more remote than London. Joan was now bird-like in her frailty, her bones visible through the translucent skin. She'd made it clear that she wished to die at home, not in the hospital in Truro. So she lay, tiny and shrunken, in the large double bed that dominated the bedroom, a bed that had been purchased to accommodate Ted's bulk back when he'd been a tall, fit, and muscular man, late of the Royal Military Police, and subsequently a stalwart member of the local lifeguard. By day, Strike, Ted, and Lucy took it in turns to sit beside Joan's bed, because awake or asleep, she liked to know that one of them was nearby. Carenza came morning and afternoon, and these were the only times when her family left the room. Joan was no longer able to swallow medication, so Carenza began injecting the morphine through a syringe driver. Strike knew that she washed his aunt and helped her perform still more private functions. The long convalescence after his amputation had left him under no illusion about what nurses dealt with. Kind, efficient, and humane. Carenza was one of the few people Strike welcomed gladly into the drafty kitchen. And still Joan clung on. 3 days after their arrival, four, she slept almost constantly, but still she clung to life.
"It's you two," said Ted. "She doesn't want to go while you two are here."
Strike was coming to dread silences too large for human voices to fill. His nerves were stretched by the constant clinking of teaspoons in hot drinks, made for something to do, by the tears shed by Uncle Ted when he thought nobody was looking, by the hushed inquiries of well-meaning neighbours. On the fifth day, Lucy's husband Greg arrived with their three boys. Husband and wife had debated how sensible it was to take the boys out of school and risk a journey that remained tricky, though the storms had at last subsided, but Lucy could bear their absence no longer. When Greg arrived, the boys came running out of the car towards their mother, and the whole family clung to each other, while Strike and Ted looked on, united in their aloneness, unmarried man, and soon-to-be widower. The boys were led up to Joan's bedroom to see her, and she managed smiles for all of them. Even Luke was subdued afterwards, and Jack cried. Both spare rooms were now needed to accommodate the new arrivals, so Strike returned, uncomplaining, to sleep on the sofa.
"You look like shit,"
Polwarth informed him bluntly on day six, and indeed Strike, who'd woken every hour on the horsehair sofa, felt it.
"Let's get a pint."
"Can I come?"
asked Jack hopefully. He was showing a tendency to hang around Strike rather than his father, while Lucy sat upstairs with Joan.
"You can if your dad says it's okay," said Strike.
Greg, who was currently walking around the garden with his phone clamped to his ears, trying to contribute to a conference call with his London office while Luke and Adam played football around him, agreed with a thumbs up. So Strike, Polwarth and Jack walked down into St. Maur's together. Though the sky was dark and the road still wet, the winds had at last dropped. As they reached the seafront, Strike's mobile rang. He answered it, still walking.
"Strike?"
"It's Shanker. Got your message."
"I left that 10 days ago," said Strike.
"I've been busy, you ungrateful piece of shit."
"Sorry," said Strike.
He waved the other two on and paused again at the harbour wall, looking out at the green-grey sea and the hazy horizon.
"I've nosed around a bit," said Shanker, "and you're not going to find out who that bimp was, Bunsen, the one on the film. Nobody knows. She'll have done something fucking serious to get that, though."
"Deserved it, you reckon?" said Strike, as he surveyed the flat sea.
It didn't look capable now of the violence it had inflicted upon the town.
"I'm not saying she deserved. I'm saying even Mucky Ritchie didn't make an habit of that," said Shanker impatiently. "Are you in solitary?"
"What?"
"Where the fuck are you? There's no noise."
"In Cornwall."
For a moment, Strike expected Shanker to ask where that was. Shanker was almost impressively ignorant of the country that lay beyond London.
"What the fuck are you doing in Cornwall?"
"My aunt's dying."
"Oh, shit," said Shanker. "Sorry."
"Where is he now?"
"Who?"
"Ritchie."
"He's in an home, I told you."
"All right. Thanks for trying, Shanker. Appreciate it."
For perhaps the first time ever, it was Shanker who shouted at Strike to stop him hanging up.
"Oi! Oi!"
"What?"
said Strike, raising the mobile to his ear again.
"Why do you want to know where he is? You ain't going to go talking to Ritchie. You're done."
"I'm not done," said Strike, eyes screwed up against the sea breeze.
"I haven't found out what happened to the doctor yet." "Fuck's sake! Do you want to get shot through the fucking head?"
"See you, Shanker," said Strike.
And before his old friend could say anything else, he cut the call and muted his phone. Polwarth was already at a table with Jack when Strike reached the Victory, 2 pints and a Coke on the table.
"Just been telling Jack,"
Polwarth told Strike, as the detective sat down.
"Haven't I, eh?"
he asked Jack, who nodded, beaming.
"For when he's older. This is his local."
"A pub 300 miles from where he lives."
"He was born in Cornwall. He was just telling me."
"Oh, yeah," said Strike. "I forgot about that."
The family had been staying with Ted and Joan when Lucy went into labour a month early. Jack had been born in the same Truro hospital as Strike himself.
"And you're a Nan Carrow on your mum's side,"
Polwarth told Jack, who was greatly enjoying Polwarth's approval.
"So that makes you a Cornishman, born and bred."
Polwarth turned to Strike.
"Who was the pearly king on the phone there? We could hear his cockney a mile off."
"Guy called Shanker," said Strike. "I've told you about him. My mum scraped him off the street one night when he'd been stabbed. He adopted us."
Strike sipped his pint, wondering how Polwarth and Shanker would get on in the unlikely event of them ever meeting. He fancied they might end up punching each other. They seemed to Strike like pieces from entirely different jigsaw puzzles. No point of connection. At the mention of stabbing, Polwarth had glanced at Jack, but lowering his pint, Strike said,
"Don't worry about him. He wants to be a red cap, like me and Ted."
Jack beamed some more. He was having a great time.
"Can I try some of that beer?"
he asked his uncle.
"Don't push it," said Strike.
"Look at this,"
said Polwarth, pointing at a page in the newspaper he'd picked up.
"Westminster trying to bully the Scots, the bastard!"
Strike cleared his throat. Jack giggled.
"Sorry," said Polwarth, "but come on. Telling them they can't keep the pound if they vote for independence? Course they'll keep the pound. It's in everyone's interests."
He talked on for the next 10 minutes about small nationalism, the obvious arguments for both Scottish and Cornish independence, and the idiocy of those who oppose them, until Jack looked glazed, and Strike, as a last resort, dragged the conversation back to football. Arsenal, as he'd foreseen, had lost to defending champions Bayern Munich, and he didn't doubt the second leg would see them knocked out. He and Ted had watched the game together and done a good job of pretending they cared about the result. Strike permitted Polworth to pass censorious comment on the foul that had seen Chesney sent off, and politics was mercifully dropped. Strike thought about Polworth later that night, as he lay in the dark on the horsehair sofa again, unable to sleep. His tiredness now had a feverishness about it, exacerbated by the aching of his body, the perpetual strain of being here, in this overcrowded house, waiting for the tiny body upstairs to give up. In this near-fever state, a jumble of ideas circulated in Strike's mind. He thought of categories and boundaries, of those we want to create and enforce, and those we seek to escape or destroy. He remembered the fanatic glint in Polworth's eye as he argued for a harder boundary between his country and the rest of England. He fell asleep thinking about the spurious groupings of astrology, and dreamed of Leda laying out her tarot cards in the Norfolk commune of long ago. Strike was woken at 5 by his own aching body. Knowing that Ted would be awake soon, he got up and dressed, ready to take over the bedside vigil while his uncle ate breakfast. Sure enough, hearing Strike's footstep on the upstairs landing, Ted emerged from the bedroom in his dressing gown.
"Just made you tea," whispered Strike. "It's in the pot in the kitchen. I'll sit with her for a bit." "You're a good lad," whispered Ted, clapping Strike on the arm. "She's asleep now, but I had a little chat with her at 4. Most she said for days."
The talk with his wife seemed to have cheered him. He set off downstairs for his tea, and Strike let himself quietly into the familiar room, taking up his position on the hard-backed chair beside Joan. The wallpaper hadn't been changed, so far as Strike knew, since Ted and Joan had moved into the house, their only home since he'd left the army, in the town where both had grown up. Ted and Joan seemed not to notice that the house had grown shabby over the decades. For all that Joan was meticulous about cleanliness, she'd equipped and decorated the house once and seemed never to have seen any need to do so again. The paper was decorated with small bunches of purple flowers, and Strike could remember tracing geometric shapes between them with his forefinger as a small child. When he climbed into bed with Ted and Joan early in the morning, when both were still sleepy and he wanted breakfast and a trip to the beach. 20 minutes after he'd sat down, Joan opened her eyes and looked at Strike so blankly that he thought she didn't know him.
"It's me, Joan," he said quietly,
moving his chair a little closer to her bed and switching on the lamp with its fringed shade.
"Corm, Ted's having breakfast."
Joan smiled. Her hand was a tiny claw now. The fingers twitched. Strike took it into his own. She said something he couldn't hear, and he lowered his large head to her face.
"What did you say?"
"You're good man."
"Oh, I don't know about that," muttered Strike.
He held her hand in a light clasp, scared of putting pressure on it. The arcus senilis outlining the irises of her pale eyes made the blue seem more faded than ever. He thought of all the times he could have visited and hadn't, all those missed opportunities to call, all those times he'd forgotten her birthday.
"Helping people."
She peered up at him and then, making a supreme effort, she whispered,
"I'm proud of you."
He wanted to speak, but something was blocking his throat. After a few seconds, he saw her eyelids drooping.
"I love you, Joan."
The words came out so hoarsely, they were almost inaudible. But he thought she smiled as she sank back into a sleep from which she was never to wake.
Chapter 45.
Of ancient time there was a springing well, from which fast trickled forth a silver flood, full of great virtues, and for medicine good. Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen. Robin was still at the office when Strike called that evening with the news that Joan had died.
I'm sorry about this, but I think I'm going to have to stay down here until we get this funeral sorted, said Strike. There's a lot to do, and Ted's in pieces.
He just shared Joan's plans for her funeral with Ted and Lucy, thereby reducing both of them to sobs at the kitchen table. Ted's tears were for the poignancy of his wife making arrangements for his own comfort and relief, as she'd done for the 50 years of their marriage, and for the news that she'd wanted, at the end, to enter the sea and wait for him there. In Lucy's case, the sobs were for the lost possibility of a grave she'd hoped to visit and tend. Lucy filled her days with voluntary obligations. They gave purpose and form to a life she was determined would never be like her flighty biological mother's.
No problem, Robin reassured him. We're coping fine.
You sure?
Completely sure.
There's a backlog at the crematorium because of the floods, said Strike. Funeral's penciled in for March the 3rd.
This was the day Robin was planning to spend in Leamington Spa, so she could attend the opening of Paul Satchwell's exhibition. She didn't tell Strike this. She could tell that he had limited mental capacity right now for anything other than Joan and his life in Cornwall.
Don't worry, she repeated. I'm so sorry, Cormoran, she added.
Thanks, said Strike. I'd forgotten what it's like, planning a funeral. I've already had to referee one argument.
After he shared Joan's plans for her send-off, and Lucy and Ted had mopped up their tears, Ted had suggested they ask mourners for donations to the Macmillan Cancer Support in lieu of flowers.
But Lucy says Joan would have wanted flowers, Strike told Robin. I've suggested we say either. Ted says that'll mean people do both and they can't afford it, but fuck it. Lucy's right. Joan would want flowers, and as many as possible. That's how she always judged other people's funerals.
After they'd bidden each other goodbye, Robin sat for a while at the partner's desk, wondering whether it would be appropriate for the agency to send flowers to Strike's aunt's funeral. She'd never met Joan. She worried that it would seem odd or intrusive to send condolences. She remembered how, when she'd offered to pick Strike up from Joan's house in St. Moore's the previous summer, he'd quickly cut her off, erecting as ever a firm boundary between Robin and his personal life. Yawning, Robin shut down the computer, closed the completed file on postcard, which she'd been updating, got to her feet, and went to get her coat. At the outer door she stopped, her reflection blank-faced in the dark glass. Then, as though responding to an unheard command, she returned to the inner office, switched the computer back on, and before she could second-guess herself, ordered a sheaf of dark pink roses to be delivered to St. Moore's Church on March the 3rd, with the message, "With deepest sympathy from Robin, Sam, Andy, Saul, and Pat." Robin spent the rest of the month working without respite. She conducted a final meeting with the persecuted weatherman and his wife, in which she revealed Postcard's identity, gave them Postcard's real name and address, and took their final payment. She then had Pat contact their waiting list client, the commodities broker, who suspected her husband of sleeping with their nanny, and, next day, welcomed the woman to the office to take down her details and receive a down payment. The commodities broker didn't bother to hide her disappointment that she was meeting Robin instead of Strike. She was a thin, colourless blonde of 42, whose over-highlighted hair had the texture, close up, of fine wire. Robin found her unlikable until the end of the interview, when she talked about her husband, whose business had gone bankrupt and who now worked from home, giving him many long hours alone with the nanny.
14 years, said the broker. 14 years, 3 kids, and now...
She hid her eyes behind her shaking hands, and Robin, who'd been with Matthew since she was at school, felt, in spite of the woman's brittle facade, an unexpected glow of sympathy. After the new client had left, Robin called Morris into the office and gave him the job of the first day's surveillance of the nanny.
"Okie dokie," he said. "Hey, what do you say we call the client RB?
"What's that stand for?" Robin asked.
"Rich bitch," said Morris, grinning. "She's loaded."
"No," said Robin, unsmiling.
"Whoops,"
said Morris, eyebrows raised. Feminist alert?
Something like that.
Okay, how about we'll call her Mrs. Smith,
after the street they live on, said Robin coldly.
Over the next few days, Robin took her turn tailing the nanny, a glossy-haired brunette who somewhat reminded her of Strike's ex-girlfriend, Lorelei. The commodities broker's children certainly seemed to adore their nanny, and so, Robin feared, did their father. While he didn't once touch the nanny in any amorous way, he showed every sign of a man completely smitten, mirroring her body language, laughing excessively at her jokes, and hurrying to open doors and gates for her. A couple of nights later, Robin dozed off at the wheel for a few seconds while driving towards Eleanor Dean's house in Stoke Newington. Jerking awake, she immediately turned on the radio and opened the window so that her eyes streamed with a cold, sooty night air. But the incident scared her. Over the next few days, she increased her caffeine consumption in an effort to keep awake. This made her slightly jittery, and she found it hard to sleep, even on the rare occasions the chance presented itself. Robin had always been as careful with the firm's money as Strike himself, treating every penny spent as though it were to be deducted from her own take-home pay. The habit of parsimony had stayed with her, even though the agency's survival no longer depended on extracting money from clients before the final demands came in. Robin was well aware that Strike took very little money out of the business for his own needs, preferring to plough profits back into the agency. He continued to live a Spartan existence in the 2.5 rooms over the office, and there were months when she, the salaried partner, took home more pay than the senior partner and founder of the firm. All of this added to her feeling of guilt at booking herself into a premier inn in Leamington Spa on the Sunday night before Satchwell's art exhibition. The town was only a 2-hour drive away. Robin knew she could have got up early on Monday morning instead of sleeping over in the town. However, she was so exhausted, she feared dozing off at the wheel again. She justified the hotel room to herself by leaving 24 hours ahead of the exhibition's opening, thus giving herself time to take a look at the church, where Margot had allegedly been sighted a week after her disappearance. She also packed photocopies of all the pages of Talbot's horoscope notes that mention Paul Satchwell, with the intention of studying them in the quiet of her hotel room. To these, she added a second-hand copy of Evangeline Adams' Your Place in the Sun, a pack of unopened tarot cards, and a copy of the Book of Thoth. She hadn't told Strike she bought any of these items, and didn't intend claiming expenses for them. Much as she loved London, Yorkshire-born Robin sometimes pined for trees, moors, and hills. Her drive up the nondescript M40, past hamlets and villages with archaic names like Middleton Cheney, Temple Herdwick, and Bishop's Itchington, gave her glimpses of flat green fields. The cool, damp day bore a welcome whiff of spring in the air, and in the breaks between scudding white clouds, hard, bright sunshine filled the old Land Rover with a light that made a pale grey ghost of Robin's reflection in the dusty window beside her. She really needed to clean the car. In fact, there were sundry small personal chores piling up while she worked non-stop for the agency, such as ringing her mother, whose calls she'd been avoiding, and her lawyer, who'd left a message about the upcoming mediation, not to mention plucking her eyebrows, buying herself a new pair of flat shoes, and sorting out a bank transfer to Max, covering her half of the council tax. As the hedgerows flashed by, Robin consciously turned her thoughts away from these depressing mundanities to Paul Satchwell. She doubted she'd find him in Leamington Spa, being unable to imagine why the 75-year-old would want to leave his home on Kos merely to visit the provincial art gallery. Satchwell had probably sent his paintings over from Greece, or else given permission for them to be exhibited. Why would he leave what Robin imagined as a dazzling white-walled villa, an artist's studio, set among olive groves? Her plan was to pretend an interest in buying or commissioning one of his paintings, so as to get his home address. For a moment or two, she indulged herself in a little fantasy of flying out to Greece with Strike to interrogate the old artist. She imagined the oven blast of heat that would hit them on leaving the plane in Athens, and saw herself in a dress and sandals, heading up a dusty track to Satchwell's front door. But when her imagination showed her Strike in shorts, with a metal rod of his prosthetic leg on display, she felt suddenly embarrassed by her own imaginings, and closed the little fantasy down before it took her to the beach, or the hotel. On the outskirts of Leamington Spa, Robin followed the sign to All Saints Church, which she knew from her research was the only possible candidate for the place where Charlie Ramage had seen Margot. Janice had mentioned a big church. All Saints was a tourist attraction due to its size. None of the other churches in Leamington Spa had graveyards attached to them. Moreover, All Saints was situated directly on the route of anyone travelling north from London. Although Robin found it hard to understand why Margot would have been browsing headstones in Leamington Spa, while her husband begged for information of her whereabouts in the national press, and her Leamington-born lover remained in London, she had a strange feeling that seeing the church for herself would give her a better idea as to whether Margot had ever been there. The missing doctor was becoming very real to Robin. She managed to secure a parking space in Priory Terrace, right beside the church, and set off on foot around the perimeter, marvelling at the sheer scale of the place. It was a staggering size for a relatively small town. In fact, it looked more like a cathedral, with its long arched windows. Turning right into Church Street, she noted the further coincidence of the street name being so similar to Margot's home address. On the right, a low wall topped with railings provided an ideal spot for a motorbike rider to park and enjoy a cup of tea from his thermos, looking at the graveyard. Except that there was no graveyard. Robin came to an abrupt standstill. She could see only two tombs, raised stone caskets whose inscriptions had been eroded. Otherwise, there was simply a wide stretch of grass intersected with two footpaths.
"Bomb fell on it!"
A cheery-looking mother was walking towards Robin, pushing a double pushchair containing sleeping boy twins. She'd correctly interpreted Robin's sudden halt.
"Yeah, in 1940, said the woman, slowing down. "Luftwaffe."
"Wow,
awful,"
said Robin, imagining the smashed earth, the broken tombstones, and perhaps fragments of coffin and bone.
"Yeah, but they missed them too,"
said the woman, pointing at the aged tomb standing in the shadow of a yew tree. One of the twin toddlers gave a little stretch in his sleep, and his eyelids flickered. With a comical grimace at Robin, the mother took off again at a brisk walk. Robin walked into the enclosed area that had once been a graveyard, looking around and wondering what to make of Ramage's story now. There hadn't been a graveyard here in 1974, when he claimed to have seen Margot browsing among tombstones. Or had an intact cemetery been assumed by Janice Beattie when she heard that Margot was looking at graves? Robin turned to look at the two surviving tombs. Certainly, if Margot had been examining these, she'd have been brought within feet of a motorcyclist parked beside the church. Robin placed her hands on the cold black bars that kept the curious from actually touching the old tombs, and examined them. What could have drawn Margot to them? The inscriptions etched on the mossy stone were almost illegible. Robin tilted her head, trying to make them out. Was she seeing things? Did one of the words say Virgo? Or had she spent too much time dwelling on Talbot's horoscope notes? Yet the more she studied it, the more like Virgo the name looked. Robin associated that star sign with two people these days, her estranged husband Matthew and Dorothy Oakden, the widowed practice secretary at Margot's old place of work. Robin had become so adept at reading Talbot's horoscope notes that she routinely heard Dorothy in her head when looking at the glyph for Virgo. Now she took out her phone, looked up the tomb, and felt mildly reassured to discover that she wasn't seeing things. This was the last resting place of one James Virgo Dunn. But why should it have been of interest to Margot? Robin scrolled down a genealogy page for the Virgos and the Duns and learned that the man whose bones now lay in dust a few feet from her had been born in Jamaica, where he'd been the owner of 46 slaves.
No need to feel sorry for you, then, Robin muttered, returning her phone to her pocket. And she walked on around the perimeter to the front of the church until she reached the great oak and iron double front doors. As she headed up the stone steps towards them, she heard the low hum of a hymn. Of course, it was Sunday morning. After a moment's hesitation, Robin opened the door as quietly as possible and peered inside. An immense, somber space was revealed. Chilly parabolas of grey stone, 100 feet of cold air between congregation and ceiling. Doubtless a church of this gigantic size had been deemed necessary back in Regency times, when people had flocked to the spa town to drink its waters, but the modern congregation didn't come close to filling it. A black-robed verger looked around at her. Robin smiled apologetically, quietly closed the door, and returned to the pavement, where a large modern steel sculpture, part squiggle, part coil, was evidently supposed to represent the medicinal spring around which the town had been built. A pub nearby was just opening its doors, and Robin fancied a coffee. So she crossed the road and entered the old library. The interior was large, but hardly less gloomy than the church, the decor mostly shades of brown. Robin bought herself a coffee, settled herself in a tucked-away corner where she couldn't be observed, and sank into abstraction. Her glimpse of the church's interior had told her nothing. Margot had been an atheist, but churches were some of the few places a person could sit and think, undisturbed. Might Margot have been drawn to All Saints out of that unfocused, inchoate need that had once driven Robin herself into an unknown graveyard, there to sit on a wooden bench and contemplate the parlous state of her marriage? Robin set down her coffee cup, opened the messenger bag she'd brought with her, and took out the wad of photocopies of those pages of Talbot's notebook that mentioned Paul Satchwell. Smoothing them flat, she glanced up casually at the two men who just sat down at a nearby table. The one with his back to her was tall and broad, with dark curly hair, and before she could remind herself that he couldn't be Strike because her partner was in St. Maur's, a thrill of excitement and happiness passed through her. The stranger seemed to have felt Robin looking at him, because he turned before she could avert her eyes. She caught a glimpse of eyes as blue as Morris's, a weak chin, and a short neck, before she bowed her head to examine the horoscope notes, feeling herself turn red, and suddenly unable to take in the mass of drawings and symbols in front of her. Waves of shame were crashing over her, entirely disproportionate to catching a stranger's eye. In the pit of her stomach, the last sparks of the excitement she'd felt on thinking she was looking at Strike glimmered and died. It was a momentary error of perception, she told herself. There's absolutely nothing to worry about. Calm down. But instead of reading the notes, Robin put her face in her hands. In this strange bar, her resistance lowered by exhaustion, Robin knew she'd been avoiding the question of what she really felt about Strike for the past year. Busy trying to disentangle herself from Matthew, familiarizing herself with a new flat and a new flatmate, managing and deflecting her parents' anxiety and judgment, fending off Morris's constant badgering, dodging Isla's infuriating determination to matchmake, and working twice as hard as ever before, it had been easy not to think about anything else, even a question as fraught as what she really felt for Cormoran Strike. Now, in the corner of this dingy brown pub, with nothing else to distract her, Robin found herself thinking back to those honeymoon nights spent pacing the fine white sand after Matthew had gone to bed, when Robin had interrogated herself about whether she was in love with a man who'd then been her boss, not her partner. She'd worn a deep channel on the beach as she walked up and down in the dark, finally deciding that the answer was no, that what she felt was a mixture of friendship, admiration and gratitude for the opportunity he'd given her to embark on a once-dreamed-of career which she thought was closed to her forever. She liked her partner. She admired him. She was grateful to him. That was it. That was all. Except. She remembered how much pleasure it had given her to see him sitting in Notes Cafe after a week's absence, and how happy she was no matter the circumstances, to see Strike's name light up her phone. Almost scared now, she forced herself to think about how bloody aggravating Strike could be. Grumpy, taciturn and ungrateful, and nowhere near as handsome, with his broken nose and hair he himself described as pube-like, as Matthew, or even Morris. But he was her best friend. This admission, held at bay for so long, caused an almost painful twist in Robin's heart, not least because she knew it would be impossible ever to tell Strike so. She could just imagine him lumbering away from her like a startled bison at such a naked statement of affection, redoubling the barriers he liked to erect if ever they got too close to each other. Nevertheless, there was a kind of relief in admitting the painful truth. She cared deeply for her partner. She trusted him on the big things, to do the right thing for the right reasons. She admired his brains and appreciated his doggedness, not to mention the self-discipline, all the more admirable, because many whole-bodied men had never mastered it. She was often astonished by his almost total lack of self-pity. She loved the drive for justice that she shared, that unbreakable determination to settle and to solve. And there was something more, something highly unusual. Strike had never once made her feel physically uncomfortable. Two of them, in the office, for a long time the only workers at the agency, and while Robin was a tall woman, he was far bigger, and he'd never made her feel it, as so many men did, not even in an attempt to intimidate, but because they enjoy the parade, as a peacock spreads its tail. Matthew hadn't been able to get past the idea of them together all the time, in a small office space, hadn't been able to believe that Strike wasn't capitalizing on the situation to make advances, however subtle. But Robin, who'd forever be hypersensitive to the uninvited touch, the sidelong lecherous glance, the invasion of personal space, the testing of conventional limits, had never once experienced with Strike that shrinking sensation within her own skin evoked by attempts to push a relationship into a different space. A deep reserve lay over Strike's private life, and while that sometimes frustrated her, had he or had he not called Charlotte Campbell back, his love of privacy extended to a respect for other people's boundaries. Never had there been an ostensibly helpful but unnecessary touch, no hand on the small of the back, no grasping of the arm, no look that made her skin prickle or made her want to cover herself. The legacy of those violent encounters with men that had left her scarred in more ways than the visible. In truth, why not admit everything to herself now, when she was so tired, her defences lowered? She was aware of only two moments in 4 years where she'd been sure that Strike had seen her as a desirable woman, not as a friend or an apprentice or a younger sister. The first had been when she'd modelled that green Cavalli dress for him, in the course of their first investigation together, when he'd looked away from her as a man would if shunning too bright light. She'd been embarrassed by her own behaviour afterwards. She hadn't meant to make him think she was trying to be seductive or provocative. All she'd been trying to do was get information out of the sales assistant. But when he'd subsequently given her the green dress, thinking he'd never see her again, she wondered whether part of the message Strike had been trying to convey was that he didn't disavow that look, that she had, indeed, looked wonderful in the dress, and this suspicion hadn't made her feel uncomfortable, but happy and flattered. The second moment, far more painful to remember, had been when she'd stood at the top of the stairs at her wedding venue, Strike below her, and he turned when she called his name and looked up at her, the new bride. He'd been injured and exhausted, and again, she'd seen a flicker of something in his face that wasn't mere friendship, and they'd hugged. And she'd felt best not to think about it. Best not to dwell on that hug, on how like home it had felt, on how a kind of insanity had gripped her at that moment, that she'd imagined him saying, "Come with me," and known she'd have gone if he had. Robin swept the horoscope papers off the pub table, stuffed them back into her messenger bag and went outside, leaving half her coffee undrunk. Trying to walk off her memories, she crossed a small stone bridge spanning the slow-flowing River Leam, which was spotted with clumps of duckweed, and past the colonnade of the Royal Pump Rooms, where Satchwell's exhibition would open the following day. Striding briskly, her hands in her pockets, Robin tried to focus on the parade, where shop fronts disfigured what had once been a sweeping white Regency terrace. But Leamington Spa did nothing to raise her spirits. On the contrary, it reminded her too much of another spa town, Bath, where Matthew had gone to university. For Robin, long symmetrical curves of Regency buildings with their plain classical facades would forever conjure once fond memories, disfigured by later discoveries. Visions of herself and Matthew strolling hand in hand, overlain by the knowledge that, even then, he'd been sleeping with Sarah. "Oh, bugger everything," Robin muttered, blinking tears out of her eyes. She turned abruptly and headed all the way back to the Land Rover. Having parked the car closer to the hotel, she made a detour into the nearby co-op to buy a small stash of food, then checked in at the self-service machine in her Premier Inn and headed upstairs to her single room. It was small, bare, but perfectly clean and comfortable, and overlooked a spectacularly ugly town hall of red and white brick, which was over-embellished with scrolls, pediments, and lions. A couple of sandwiches, a chocolate eclair, a can of Diet Coke and an apple made Robin feel better. As the sun slowly sank behind the buildings on the parade, she slipped off her shoes and reached into her bag for the photocopied pages of Talbot's notebook and her pack of Thoth tarot cards, which Alistair Crowley had devised, and in which Bill Talbot had sought the solution to Margot's disappearance. Sliding the pack out of the box into her hand, she shuffled through the cards, examining the images. Just as she'd suspected, Talbot had copied many motifs into his notebook, presumably from those cards which had come up during his frequent attempts to solve the case by consulting the tarot. Robin now flattened a photocopy of what she thought of as the horns page, on which Talbot had dwelled on the three horn signs of the zodiac, Capricorn, Aries, and Taurus. This page came in the last quarter of the notebook, in which quotations from Alistair Crowley, astrological symbols, and strange drawings appeared far more often than concrete facts. Here on the horns page was evidence of Talbot's renewed interest in Satchwell, whom he'd first ruled out on the basis that he was an Aries rather than a Capricorn. Talbot had evidently calculated Satchwell's whole birth horoscope and taken the trouble to note various aspects, which he'd noticed were same as AC, same as AC, and don't forget LS connection. To add to the confusion, the mysterious Schmidt kept correcting signs, although he'd allowed Satchwell to keep his original sign of Aries. And then an odd idea came to Robin. The notion of a 14-sign zodiac was clearly ludicrous. But why was it more ludicrous than a 12-sign zodiac? Asked a voice in her head, which sounded remarkably like Strike's. But certainly, if you were going to squeeze in an extra 2 signs, dates would have to shift, wouldn't they? She picked up her mobile and googled 14-sign zodiac Schmidt.
"Oh, my God," said Robin aloud, into her still hotel room.
Before she could fully process what she'd read, the mobile in her hand rang. It was Strike.
"Hi,"
said Robin, hastily turning him to speakerphone so she could continue reading what she'd just found.
"How are you?"
"Knackered," said Strike, who sounded it. "What's happened?"
"What do you mean?"
asked Robin, her eyes rapidly scanning lines of text.
"You sound like you do when you found something out."
Robin laughed.
"Oh, okay, but you won't believe this. But I've just found Schmidt."
"You've what?"
"Schmidt, first name Stephen. He's a real person. He wrote a book in 1970 called Astrology 14, proposing the inclusion of 2 extra signs in the zodiac, Ophiuchus, the serpent-bearer, and Cetus, the whale."
There was a brief silence, then Strike muttered,
"How the hell did I miss that?"
"Remember that statue of the man holding the serpent at Margot's old house?"
said Robin, falling back on her pillows among the scattered tarot cards.
"Asclepius," said Strike. "Ophiuchus was the Roman form, god of healing."
"Well, this explains all the changing dates, doesn't it?"
said Robin. And why poor Talbot got so confused. He was trying to put everyone into Schmidt's adjusted dates, but they didn't seem to fit. And all the other astrologers he was consulting were still using the 12-sign system, so...
Yeah, said Strike, talking over her. That'd make a crazy man crazier, all right. His tone said, this is interesting, but not important.
Robin moved the three of discs from beneath her and examined it absent-mindedly. Robin was now so well-versed in astrological symbols that she didn't need to look at the glyphs to know that it also represented Mars in Capricorn. How are things with you? She asked.
Well, the church isn't going to hold everyone who's coming tomorrow, which Joan would have been thrilled about. I just wanted to let you know I'll be heading back up the road again on Tuesday.
Are you sure you don't need to stay longer?
The neighbours are all promising they're going to look after Ted. Lucy's trying to get him to come up to London for a bit afterwards. Any other news your end?
Let's see. I wrapped up postcard, said Robin. I think our weatherman was quite disappointed when he saw who his stalker was. His wife cheered up no end, though.
Strike gave a grunt of laughter.
So we've taken on the commodities broker, Robin continued. We haven't got pictures of anything incriminating between a husband and nanny yet, but I don't think it's going to be long.
You're owed a long stretch off for all this, Robin, said Strike gruffly. I can't thank you enough.
Don't be silly, she said.
They hung up shortly afterwards.
Robin's room seemed to have become suddenly much darker. The sun had gone down. In silhouette, the town hall resembled a monstrous Gothic palace. She turned on her bedside lamp and looked around at the bed strewn with astrological notes and tarot cards. Seen in the light of Strike's lack of enthusiasm, Talbot's doodles looked like the determinedly weird drawings on the back of a teenager's jotter, leading nowhere, done purely for the love of strangeness. Yawning, she refolded the photocopied notes and put them back in her bag, went for a shower, returned in her pyjamas to the bed, and gathered up the tarot cards, putting them in order as she did so, to make sure none of them were missing. She didn't particularly want the cleaner to think of her as the kind of person who left tarot cards strewn in her wake. On the point of replacing the deck in its box, Robin suddenly sat down on the bed and began to shuffle it instead. She was too tired to attempt the 15-card layout advocated in the little booklet that accompanied the tarot, but she knew from her exhaustive examination of his notes that Talbot had sometimes tried to see his way through the investigation by laying out just 3 cards, the first representing the nature of the problem, the second, the cause, and the third, the solution. After a minute's shuffling, Robin turned over the top card and laid it down in the pool of light cast by her bedside lamp. The Prince of Cups. A naked bluish-green man rode an eagle, which was diving towards water. He held a goblet containing a snake in one hand and a lotus flower in the other. Robin pulled the Book of Thoth out of her bag and looked up the meaning. The moral characteristics of the person pictured in this card are subtlety, secret violence, and craft. He is intensely secret, an artist in all his ways. She thought immediately of Dennis Creed, a master of murder in his way. She turned over the next card, the 4 of Cups, or luxury. Another lotus was pouring water over 4 more goblets, golden this time. Robin turned to the book. The card refers to the moon in Cancer, which is her own house. But Cancer itself is so placed that this implies a certain weakness, an abandonment to desire. Was the tarot criticizing her for soft living? Robin glanced around her little box of a room, then turned over the last card. More cups and yet more lotuses, and 2 entwined fish pouring out water into 2 more golden chalices, which stood on a green lake. Love. The card also refers to Venus in Cancer. It shows the harmony of the male and the female, interpreted in the largest sense. It is perfect and placid harmony. Robin inspected the card for a few more seconds before laying it down beside the other two. They were all cups. As she knew from her study of the Thoth tarot, cups meant water. Well, here she was, in a spa.